Hello everyone and welcome to The Dot Matrix, found on thedotmatrix.com and on Facebook at whatever our fan page is. I'm Justin.
And I'm Sean.
And we're on episode, as you reminded me over dinner, 31.
Yes!
Not 24, like I was thinking.
I got a little concerned there because I was like, you know, we hit the 25 episode milestone and then we hit the 30 episode milestone, and that's probably good until about 50, I guess. But
I guess.
You were like, what are we on, like 24? And I said, for a split second, I was like, what? Then I thought, are we only? And then I started, you know, all in milliseconds, started second guessing myself. But then, yeah, here we are,
yeah.
31.
Yeah, 31. It's a nice age.
Yes. That was a year ago for us, but year and a half. You're almost 33. What am I talking about?
Did you really have to say that out loud?
2 weeks. You're 33.
Don't sound so shocked.
Yeah, I shouldn't, because I'm just right behind you, really.
Well, not right behind
you,
but number of months.
You're right. I still got like 4 months, or 2 months, or 3 months, or something, yeah. So yes, lots to talk about in this Olympic atmosphere. Huh?
Yes, I think, well, we are recording this on, what, February, what day is it?
22nd.
22nd. And it is just after halfway past the middle of the halfway point of the games, which are taking place right in our backyard. So we made a point that we would podcast during the games because we wanted to document some of our thoughts, of course. But
yeah,
but I think, I mean, we're gonna pretty much focus on the games, I guess. But we wanted to talk a little bit before that about this article, and I want to get that out of the way too. Not out of the way. I want to talk about that. Give it enough airtime too, because otherwise we're gonna get rolling on the games and
won't be able to get off that
yeah.
train. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Let's talk about this article, which I didn't know because it was in the Sun, right?
Yes.
Okay. It was it
a couple weeks ago?
I thought it was the Globe and Mail, but it was in the Vancouver Sun.
Oh, it might have been the Mail too.
Oh, well, I don't get either, and because I know you check the Globe and Mail, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't check. I typically don't go to the Globe and Mail. But you get the Sun, and I don't get a newspaper delivered except for the Vancouver Courier. But,
Yes, I don't get that one. But yeah, okay.
You don't? Oh.
It comes in our building maybe once every quarter. It's, I don't know where it
really?
Comes from. Yeah, it's really weird.
Wow, that is weird. But anyways, we're not talking about newspaper deliveries. We're talking about a particular opinion piece. It was an op-ed piece.
Yeah.
It was called Vancouver's Own Not-So-Quite Revolution. Is that what the name of
yes.
the article was? And it was written by Professor Henry Yu from UBC. And for those of you who may be from this area and who get the paper might have read this article. And it was quite astoundingly...
Well, it was impassioned or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And the subtext of the article, when did it come out? It came out February...
2nd.
And it says, Vancouver's Own Not-So-Quite Revolution, and the subheading is, City has far to go before it can match diversity reflected by participants in upcoming Winter Games. So it just sort of, I guess, challenging, the article itself challenges Canada's notion of being multicultural, being inclusive, and that sort of brand of what is Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that it's not so true, there's, you know, it's especially in areas of British Columbia. I think he really just talks about the Lower Mainland, right? The Greater Vancouver. He doesn't go elsewhere, does he?
I don't even think he goes in Greater Vancouver.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just solely Vancouver.
So so he talks about Vancouver and it being...
Oh, he touches provincial-wide.
Yeah.
I think. But anyway, go ahead.
But
yeah.
You had a strong reaction to it, and then I read it after, and I think maybe I would have had a different reaction if I had just came across it myself.
Yeah.
Because you previewed the article by telling me that you had a visceral reaction to it. And then, so, tell me your thoughts first, or share your thoughts
sure.
first.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned, because I did have, like, this, it was almost like a, oh, where did this come from kind of reaction? Like, what, you know, because... What he's talking about is this colonial history of British Columbia that we have to kind of get past, or that we think we're past, and maybe we're deluding ourselves. And he gives different examples, language that kids learn in schools, You know, being French and English as national languages, and then he goes on to talk about Kitsilano being a mainly white neighborhood compared to most other areas of the city. So when I read this, I thought
piece is that he basically says that we're still a city and a province run by white people, and that the leadership in the city and the leadership in the province does not reflect the diversity of the population. But anyways, that was the last sort of, I think, main nugget of the article.
Yeah, and he talks about, you know, with people leading, like white people leading universities, white people this, white people that. And I thought, okay, well, you know, he works he teaches at UBC, so, you know, maybe he knows. But my initial reaction was like, where did this come from? It seemed a little unusual of a topic. Maybe that's because we all think we are so multicultural and diverse all the time. And then my second point was, it wasn't really that cohesive an article, because he just starts to go from here to here to here to here with this underlying theme of, well, let's say it, white supremacy, you know?
Right.
And so I was just really taken aback. Like, mm-hmm. I thought, okay, well, you know, let's give him benefit of the doubt. He's a professor. He obviously has a completely different life than I do. I'm a white Canadian, you know?
Right.
And he's obviously Asian, Canadian as well. Like, born here, I was born here, you know? So I was thinking, okay, well, what do I really think about this? And I started to think about the whole, you know, you and I talked about it, and the thing that the part of the article that really stuck out was the Kitsilano is a very white neighborhood. And I thought, well, that may be true, and why is that? So we talked about, you know, the people who, a lot of people who live there, the homes and other infrastructure has been passed down through generations, and it's a very expensive neighborhood in most areas, and so it maybe not the easiest to infiltrate like some other areas, like, for example, East Van, where there's been a lot of immigration people settling over decades and stuff. And so I thought, well, maybe there isn't any simple answer or explanation for what makes a community its fabric, like it's what makes it more diverse than others, or, you know, more culturally diverse. I just felt it was kind of out of left field, and he seemed kind of angry in it. And so I sent it to you and thought, well, what do you think? And you obviously had some thoughts too.
Well, it's funny because you said the anger thing was the one that struck me first, and when you saved the next few, or Vancouver Sun, that came out like a few days later, and they had a whole bunch of comments on it, and one of the comments reads from a Jacqueline Kirby in North Vancouver. She writes, I have seldom read such a chip on your shoulder racist article. And that was the first thing that struck me, is that he was has a chip on his shoulder. I didn't quite get where it was coming from. Like,
yeah.
It sounded to me like it was an article written by, and I can see this point of view, a Chinese Canadian who's feeling very uncomfortable with his being in touch with his Asian roots. Like,
absolutely.
Like, whether or not he's ashamed of it or not, I doubt he's ashamed of it. But you know, the fact that, you know, he can't speak anything more of his language than whatever he thinks he says is in his article, right? I'm like, well, same thing with me. I'm, you know, Chinese Canadian. I'm born here. And I can't speak, you know, you speak better Cantonese than I do, right? And, and you know, and I have uncomfortableness about that, but I don't hate myself for it. And he's writing it as if he's someone who's using his self-loathing for himself as a way to use very sharp language and use
yes.
it based on racism. So I thought that was kind of weird, because he has this chip on his shoulders and talking about he's been downtrodden, but he's a professor at UBC. Like, to me, I think, I'm sure there's no doors closed to him, or very few doors closed to him, as, let's say, a lot of, you know, Chinese immigrants who come to Canada today who are doctors who can't practice their profession, right? So, and, you know, it always takes a generation. You know, everyone always says, you know, if you are an immigrant, you don't do it for yourself, you do it for your kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's a product of that, so I don't understand where the chip on the shoulder is coming from, unless he's feeling hatred to the country because on behalf of his parents. Maybe that's where it is. I don't know.
Who
so that's
knows,
the first thing that sort of struck me. And the second thing that struck me was sort of our conversation after when you sort of sent me the article, and my second reaction was the fact that, well, of course Kits doesn't have a strong Asian population in it because it's too expensive.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the turnover, I'm sure, in property in East Van, Mount Pleasant, Strathcona, you name it, any other Kingsway area or whatever, Marple, whatever, is probably a higher turnover rate than it is in Kits. You know, I mean, there's lots of apartments, which, again, when the article here says, what's wrong with Kits, and the woman, Jan Pierce, writes, Kits attracts university students and young couples because of its rental apartments.
Yeah.
It is also known as a character neighborhood with heritage homes, many with multiple units on smaller than average lots. Perhaps these qualities make it less attractive to Asians. In the end, what difference does it make?
Right.
And, I mean, there's a point to that. I don't think it's the lot size necessarily. I mean, I guess, yeah, there's some instance. If you have an immigrant family who is large, who
right.
has parents, grandparents, and grandchildren all living in the same house,
mm-hmm.
you can't live in a kid's house. It's
mm-hmm.
not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some of that. But it's what we talked about, you alluded to, is that, you know, my mother bought the house that I'm living in Kits. I'm living in Kits, and I'm an Asian guy in Kits.
Yeah.
And,
point. Yeah.
And it's, but she bought it in the late 60s, early 70s, and it's passed down to me, and I have no intention, my sister and I have no intention of selling it. We want to pass it down to our offspring or somehow in our family. We want to keep it in the family because everyone knows that's a really expensive area, and it's only going to go up. So if you have land and you have property there, you never let it go. And that's what everyone else is doing. And people who happened to buy that land when it was affordable was probably Caucasian. You know, I mean, so I think what he's using, what's his degree in? I think it's, was it sociology or something? Does it say in the article? We had the article up, by the way, for those of you who are listening at home.
Yeah, we're going to link to this article. It's just the digital version. It's at the bottom.
He's a professor of history. Okay, so he's a history professor.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe history in a cultural sense, I don't know. But, like, he really should think about, you know, real estate and you know, like some, you know, that sort of sense. Like, there's other parts of history that isn't just what you see in front of you. And I think if you look at real estate records and turnover rates of homes and how often do houses go on the market and
yeah.
that sort of stuff, I'm sure it's much lower.
Well, and that's a very good point, because that's probably the third thing I thought of when I read it, was there's so many other variables not taken into account. You know, he's coming from one point of view. The other thing that surprised me was just his language. Colonial, you know, we are a British colony. Like, we were.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone uses that word. Like, I never think of using that word. You know? And so, what am I going to use that for? He says that white leadership at universities, a legacy of apartheid and white supremacy, and that we didn't notice the transition from our colonial past. So while it looks good, like communities look good, our society looks good reasonably compared to other countries, but there's a lot of things where we still need to work on, which is arguably true, perhaps. Another way of looking at that is, he says, visible minority is an odd term. And I agree with that, because if there's some areas, or say some communities like Richmond or you know, some other communities, who knows, you know, they all the different communities have different ratios of ethnic background, right? So when you hear terms like 55%, you know, Chinese-speaking people or whatever, then what is visible minority? Like, maybe that's something that, you know, we need to look at. Like, what does that really mean anymore, you know?
See, I mean,
think that that's colonial or white supremacist is really, I found it offensive.
Well, it's funny because I didn't take it that offensive myself. Not because I disagree with your thoughts, but I think people use words to mean things so much, you know? Like, I mean, one of the articles, Virat too, was talking about how they counted colonial war colonial 7 times, and it is very racist. And, you know, frankly...
Like, I don't think it means to be racist, but, sorry.
Anyway. And maybe that's what it is for me, is like, well, you know, but it's true. Like, not true in the sense right today, but that we were a colony from Europeans came and... colonized
right.
North America. I mean, it's just part of the history, right?
Exactly.
So I think that's totally fine to say that we were a British colony. Well, that's not racist. That's true, right? It just, but today, it's not a reflection of who we are today. And I think what he's using those words in a way to elicit some sort of visceral reaction in people. And for me, I'm thinking, you know, like... And he's trying to frame, use language that represents today, you know, and that makes relevant for today, right? But, you know, sometimes, but that's part of our cultural identity. It's part of the national identity of what is Canada by having terms that don't make any sense today, but that's just how we say it, because it doesn't mean, like, when someone used the word colonial, maybe, you know, many, many decades ago, it was a real term that meant something. But now it's just, to me, it's just me, oh, well, that's, yeah, because we were British colony at some point, whatever. And just because today 51% of the population are not born here.
Right.
Doesn't mean you can stop using the, you know, I mean, I guess I'm not really being articulate, but I guess the point is...
I know
is,
what you mean.
Like...
Colonial is in a literal...
I think people use words to mean things that people just have to remember, like, it doesn't really mean everything it used to mean, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the whole greater Metro Vancouver, Lower Mainland. That same thing. Everyone's shifting over to Metro Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about this in previous podcasts. But I think there's nothing wrong with calling it Lower Mainland. I think probably people want to do Metro Vancouver because it makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
People can understand when you're talking about Lower Mainland. No one gets what that means, right? But, you know, it just developed because we were in the lower part of the mainland of this nation, of this province. But, you know, so that makes sense to us. So why not? Like, people talk about this as the calling us as part of the Pacific Northwest. That makes absolutely no sense to us because we're not the northwest of our country. We're the
southwest,
right? But we take it for, we say, whatever, no big deal. We understand, people understand that means this area. And sometimes it includes us.
Yeah.
But I don't take offense for it. It just happens to be that frame of reference if you live in the States,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think people have to remember, it's a frame of reference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's part of our cultural identity. So it's okay. You know, it doesn't mean we have to live and breathe this racism past and feel
right.
like we have to continually, you know, whip ourselves in the back to be self-effacing or self-sacrificing or whatever. It's just... a term. It's not anything crazy. And then there was another point I wanted to make, but now I've just completely lost it.
Well, you know, he talks about how, you know, he learned French in school growing up, like you and I did.
Yeah.
Yet, you know, he can't barely speak any of it. Yet, a city like Edmonton, and he...
Yeah, but that's true though. I do agree with that.
I agree with that too. He says Edmonton, they have like Mandarin. You can learn Mandarin all through school, for example.
And they've been doing
languages.
That for 20-some years or something.
And I agree. You know, there are some points of this article that we can take something from and say, yeah, why aren't we doing that?
But I agree. I mean, when he talks about the white leadership in universities, white leadership still in the province, frankly, that's actually not untrue. You know, like. It's
not untrue, but to suggest that it there's some kind of inner workings in the background to make sure it stays that way.
Yes, yeah, I don't think
which is kind of
yeah. He's got a little bit of a conspiracy theory.
Yes,
in him.
Yes,
and I don't agree with that. I don't think there's any conspiracy theory, but it's just I think it's just how it has been, and it just you know it just.
It might take a few more generations.
That's exactly it. And it is unfortunate because sometimes decisions made with not understanding the full frame of reference of everything around you and the population, which makes up, you know, 51%, you know, of your of your citizens.
Yeah.
And not having anyone with that frame of reference to understand or to at least be able to give that voice. I see it. I think that's true. But the, that's another thing. It's a term about visible minority. I find it fascinating. If people say, yeah, well, you know, not really visible minority anymore. But I think it's kind of quirky to say that, you know, the visible minorities in this province are now the majority. And, but to still call it visible minorities because that's the frame of reference. Like, we are a British colony. So you know, so I like the dissonance that that language provides. And a lot of people find that very uncomfortable. But I find it quirky. I just find it kind of neat.
I've never been totally cool with that term.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whenever I first heard of that term, I was like, visible minority. Well, that just suggests a very superficial way of looking at things, right? Because it's what we can see. You're white, you're not white.
Yeah,
that,
but...
You know, but I, so I think he has a point there.
But I think that term, I mean, I don't, I'm not a historian or, like, a linguist, so I'm not sure. But I think, I find the term really interesting because when you think about it, the when there was the invisible minority, I'm assuming that means Irish versus Dutch versus British versus, you know, like the segregation of the different nationalities,
mm-hmm.
but under white, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're walking down the street, I mean, except for the fact that the Dutch are like 7 feet tall, like, you may not be able to tell a Dutch person from a Swedish person or a British person,
right?
Right. But a Chinese person, yes, we're 5'5" and under, that's fine. But, yeah, but we are a visible... Right, right. So I think
yeah.
it's okay. Like, I actually don't mind the term. But
yeah.
but I see your point, though. But and I think partly what where you're coming from is I think you have a an ultra-sensitivity to the fact that you are part of the white majority, in a sense, and living in this culture, I think you become more sensitive to it than probably people who live in, let's say, rural middle Canada or rural United States, you know, who
mm-hmm.
isn't, you know, you're much more cosmopolitan and you have that sense. So,
mm-hmm.
so I think it's totally fine.
He also talks about, he's almost asking or saying that society has a responsibility for children learning the mother tongues of their parents, or as in, like, if he doesn't learn Cantonese or something, whose responsibility is it for him to make sure he retains the heritage of those who came before him in his family? You know what I
right,
mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And people in those responses point out, it's like, well, wait a second, like, sure, but where does it end? Like, how many languages do we do that for? And, is there responsibility within the family? It's like Quebec, worried about their culture going.
Yes, yeah.
Well, how do you do that? Do you do that by just making sure there's no English signs? Or do you make sure that, you know, the people themselves retain it within the household and with friends and with, you know, like, so a lot,
yeah.
I don't know what the answer is there, but... But a lot of people pointed out to that as well.
Well, and I, in my view, and I've thought about this a lot, because I'm one of those people who doesn't speak Cantonese,
mm-hmm.
Although that's my heritage and part of my heritage.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has to do with family. I think you just have to be confident and comfortable in your ethnicity, in your cultural background, that it will survive. You know, like one thing I hate it when people equate language and culture. They're two separate things.
Mm-hmm.
Language is a subset of your culture,
okay.
and your cultural identity.
Okay.
So the fact that I don't speak Cantonese does not mean I'm not Chinese.
Right.
And I don't feel Chinese. That I,
and that's always the
know,
joke, right?
And it's always a joke, right? And exactly. And so I'm like, I get really angry when people equate it.
Yeah.
And he's sort of in that, you know...
Well, and you feel
you know,
that anger in the article.
And I feel very... Like, I feel very unfortunate and sad, but I don't hate myself for not knowing Cantonese. I don't feel like I'm less
no.
of a human being, because I had no choice. I mean, you develop language as you grow up, and how your parents decide to raise you is how you end up. And, you know, as an adult, if I really wanted to, I could probably learn Cantonese. It would be really, really hard, but I could try. And yeah. I know, and being in a situation, at least I would be surrounded by it, and I, you know,
yes.
people talk it, and I know how to hear it. People talk it.
people speak.
Yeah. But I don't think it's the responsibility of the school system, although I think the responsibility of the school system is to give enough opportunities for children to learn the skills and knowledge and experiences they need to learn to survive in today's world.
Mm.
And frankly, learning Mandarin, which is not Cantonese,
right,
is the way to go. And I think you should, I think we should be,
be just looking towards the lack of a better term, the trend. So
yeah.
To speak. Yeah.
Well, it's a trend, but it's also, 1. Whatever billion people, right?
Yeah.
So it's
numbers.
So I think it's, and especially where we're situated in the world, being right across the Pacific from Asia, I think it's a smart move to be teaching Mandarin. Maybe not so much Cantonese, but Mandarin.
But
right?
Mandarin. And I totally agree. And, Lane and I have talked a lot about this. And I think, why are we still learning French, way over here?
Yeah, well, I think it's a balance. I mean, French is one of the official languages, and it's not going to change. And, respectful
yeah.
of our history,
yeah.
I think that's not a problem. Have some French, but you need to supplement it with other languages.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, and it's not you, and it should not be to the school system to protect languages, I think, of your culture. I think multiculturalism does a good enough job. I mean,
yes.
we have rules and laws in this country, and although, yes, the leadership in many ways is still white, the laws of the land respects everyone's cultures, and you can, be Ghanaian and live in Canada and still feel like you're connected to Ghana, right?
And you could be a Satanist and,
you have religious freedoms and all that sort of thing too, right? Absolutely. And so I think, my responsibility if I have children is I would like them to learn. I would like them to learn Mandarin for
yeah.
sure,
yeah.
but I would like them to learn Cantonese because that's my heritage.
Right.
And I want to be the one weird blip in the generational hierarchy of my whole family that doesn't know it. I mean, a lot of my cousins know it. They do it,
mm-hmm.
and I just our family we never did in our immediate family. Right. So.
But I think that but that's also common too.
Yeah.
I don't think that's uncommon.
It's absolutely not uncommon, yeah.
And I think that's what people have to remember. And
I think he, in his article, to me, my sense is he hasn't really accepted that, or he still has an uncomfortableness about that
yeah.
for him.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are also like that, which is totally fine. I'm much more at peace about it. I think if you equate language to culture, you're going to be very uncomfortable about it. And I think my sense is that's where he's at, or potentially where he could be at. For me, I'm not. I very early on, I made that distinction. It's not the same. They're very different things. I'm Chinese. As much as I want to be Chinese, or I am Chinese, and that's fine with me,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that's where his language comes from in terms of his negativity and his chip on his shoulder. That would be my guess.
And it's funny, because I've grown up thinking, what is my cult? Everyone's got their thing. And
yeah, who are you?
We're so busy pointing out differences in each other, which has its benefits, of course, but now it's like, so I think, okay, what is my heritage? What, I know I have ancestral heritage from Europe, obviously.
Gilhuli.
Yes. So I think, but, I'm not religious, thankfully, and I don't, sure, I celebrate the big, popular holidays, like Christmas and all of that. But aside from that, there's nothing that really, makes me stick out, so to speak. And, we always talk about communities, like Chinese community, Indian community. There's communities based on kind of ethnic backgrounds, and there's communities based on national
yeah.
Backgrounds.
Yeah.
All these culture clubs everywhere. And I think, well, it's good, but I just want us to be all so welcoming inside all those different, groups and factions and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, that's we always talk, like one guy pointed out in one of the responses is that English is, it's good that everyone knows English because we can all communicate with each other, and that may be kind of simplistic, but it, I think, you know, we don't want to separate ourselves so much. Like when you think of Vancouver, you can, how many neighborhoods can you point out? Well, you can probably point out many different neighborhoods, but you know, there's this pride that comes with those neighborhoods, but there's also this kind of, there's a bit of a division too.
Yeah.
Is that unfair or is that?
No. Well, I've said this before in other circumstances, not necessarily on this podcast, but the problem with Vancouver is there's too many of a whole series of ethnicities and cultures or neighborhoods. When I lived in Ottawa, I actually felt the Chinatown in Ottawa was so much more inclusive than here.
Yeah.
Just because there wasn't that many. And so a lot of the French, you know, Canadians and the English Canadians, you know, in Ottawa, it's very much French Canada and
Canada,
right? They were all going to, like, I'd never seen so many Caucasian people in a Chinese restaurant in Chinatown before.
Oh.
Because they are the majority.
Yeah.
So they feel totally fine.
To relax
and to be out and just to be trying everything, right?
Right.
But when you get a critical mass, like we have here, of South Asian communities, Chinese communities, Filipino communities, whatever.
You name it.
It's easy to stay insular because there's enough of you to stay insular with.
Right.
If you are one of 10 people from your country who are living in Greater Vancouver, you cannot help but integrate, and so I won't say assimilate, but integrate into other communities or other parts of it.
Right.
But when you number in the hundreds of thousands,
yeah,
you can kind of stay in your area, or you can go and never learn English because you can go to the grocery store,
mm-hmm.
do your banking, and you know, the numbers, although it's really makes lots of things wonderful here, it does create some isolation if you want to be isolated.
Right.
But the goal then is that there's lots of leaders in these individual communities who talk about the value of multiculturalism, of understanding what the Japanese community is doing, or the,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Scottish community, or the Irish community, what are they up to, you know, and just... And it's a slow process,
mm-hmm.
and right now it's very formalized because there's such masses.
Yes.
You have to have Multiculturalism Week or Multiculturalism Festival or,
uh-huh.
you know, and that's chipping away at it.
Yeah.
Some people were resistant to that because it's too formalized. You
right.
know, like I should
okay.
just be able to walk into Little India and get some fabrics for a sari and do whatever I want to do, right?
Right.
Like I should just be able to do that and not even think about it. And that's going to take generations. It will. And it's going to take generations, frankly, of crossbreeding. You know, like, there's going to have to be a lot more interracial marriages, as much as I can't stand Rice King. Sorry, Sean. That's what's going to happen. They're going to have a lot of mixed racial children.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how it's going to... It's going to chip away. That's going to be the next big wave. Right, with when all the kids now who are part of interracial families start to grow up and date and become community leaders or whatever they
mm-hmm.
do, you know, then it's going to be like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm Hawaiian and Japanese and Scottish and Israeli, so live with it.
Yeah,
know? Like,
totally.
You know, it's... But anyways, but the last thing I will say about this topic is the way he framed Kits, and this is just coming back to the...
Which was the first thing that I noticed, yeah.
Is he made it sound like it's this sort of white enclave.
Yeah.
And,
it's like,
and,
come on,
you know,
buddy.
And frankly, you know, I do, you know, I don't notice it, but I walk around and after the article, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, there isn't, you know, a Chinese grocery store here, there isn't a, you know, or whatever. And you know, I was so excited because the pho place opened by nearby, and that's
yeah.
the first one in the neighborhood. Because there isn't that many pho places when you get in
when you get past like
Maine
Cambie
or yeah, Cambie, yeah,
yeah,
exactly. So But I have. But all that aside, I don't feel like you make it sound like if I was walking down the street, if you were an Asian walking down the street, you'd feel
like an average.
Uncomfortable, or you, people were being racist towards you. They would make you walk on the side on the street, not the sidewalk,
yeah.
or people would close their stores, go from open to closed.
Right.
I've never felt that. I don't feel any racism at all. And you know, of course, that is coming from an Asian who was born here. And maybe if I was, you know,
as he is,
exactly. So he should have the same feeling I have, which is not. I don't feel what he feels, right? But maybe, I guess, if you were, you know, someone who just came in and immigrated from Shanghai and, you know, went to the neighborhood and,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the first time after only moving into the neighborhood for, 2 weeks or something, you'd be like, okay, it's a bit different, you know? I could see that. But, you know...
But at the end of the day, it's not this big it's not this... There's not a, it's not
yeah.
the West Bank and there's this wall,
right.
you know what I mean?
Well, and I guarantee you if that Shanghainese immigrant walked into the tea store and couldn't really speak all that much, the women behind the counter would not turn their heads and go, sorry, get out of my store.
Yeah.
Or they would actually try to help that person,
yeah.
you know, order and buy tea, you know?
It's, yeah, agreed.
So anyways, that's the one thing which I just didn't get. Okay.
All right.
Wow.
Over a half hour on that topic. Okay, 5 minutes for the Olympics. That's good.
Oh. Now, I would like you to start about this Olympics conversation.
Okay.
Because, I find it really interesting, and I think you and I have... Because
we've talked about Olympics a lot.
Yes, we have.
Over the last...
And, I mean, we could go over things like talking about... You know, what do you think the opening ceremonies, which is surprisingly good.
Very
or,
good, yeah.
And
I admit it. I think it was great.
Except for every so often when the camera poked up a bit and you saw the gray of the
ceiling,
you're like, just bring it down.
Yeah.
And of course, Katie Lang and was phenomenal, and Joni Mitchell and the Prairie was really,
that was pretty cool.
Really cool. The whale, of course, if the whales are critical and cool. But anyways, we can talk about some of that if we have time at the end, and, you know, the performances, but what I find really fascinating is, you know, and it's taken me a while, I'm nearly as negative about it as you are, although I have really strong reservations, as you have as well,
yeah.
about how the Olympics have descended on this city.
Yeah.
And tarnished what has been, if you're from an outside perspective and never had an Olympics come to you, you probably still have a very fairly bright, positive shine around the Olympic ideals and everything. But once it comes to your city, your mind changes, and I changed quite considerably. And to be fairly negative, you know, frankly, fairly negative about the
whole process.
I was kind of
surprised. Yeah, you actually got kind of negative there for a while. I was like, whoa.
But I'm just curious about. Not the turnaround. It's not a turnaround. I mean, those reservations still exist today.
Mm-hmm.
They are clearly there. I disagree on a bunch of things as to how things unfolded. But the shift of your, not opinion, but your feelings on a very emotional, just gut level, now that they're here.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. I have to admit, you know, when I got here and we went down the first time at night in downtown, you couldn't ignore the feeling. For me, the coolest part is seeing people from other countries coming.
I've only seen people from Seattle.
we're on Robson, and I saw this young girl with a South Korea flag. And she looked so happy, and she's taking pictures with people. And I thought, that is cool. You know, I like that. I like people just enjoying the city and really saying a lot of great things about the city. Because you and I know that's true.
Mm.
And it's everything. Anything you know is true. When other people share that opinion, it always makes you feel good.
Yep.
You know. So, there's that. There's... how the whole logistics of it all seemed to pull off reasonably well. I think it's a almost inconceivably hard task for any group of people like Bannock or whoever ends up doing it. Putting something like this together is a mammoth task. And I think, you know, it's really, we've got some really unfair criticism in general from other countries, most notably England, which really surprised me considering they're next for the summer ones.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, I felt good about the vibe. That was overall a pretty positive vibe. And I felt happy about sharing in that. I don't think we've been arrogantly egotistical. I think there's a lot of just weird paradoxes about, or if that's the right word, about the Olympics being here that have been there enough to make me not want to rush out and be there every second.
Right, yeah.
But I am relishing the pride and the good vibes, the aesthetic of the whole thing. I'm big on aesthetic about everything, and I think that's atmosphere and things like that, and I really like that. I deep down, I knew that would happen when it came. I don't think it's euphoric, like John Furlong says it was going to be, but I think it's a really nice feeling. And overall, I've long accepted that it was coming. I think, you know, we can get into the discussion in a bit about things that aren't so great, but overall, you know, I think it's just about maybe we need, all of us need something like this to really kind of look at each other in a different way, in a more positive way, and be kinder and things like that. It kind of refreshes the memory about the interaction with one another, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's my overall feeling about it.
I thought it was interesting. I was just walking around the other day in downtown, and I saw two people with clipboards and bright orange t-shirts, and they were saying legal observers. And they're from the BC Civil Liberties Association,
oh,
the volunteers.
Right, right.
Just to observe, to make sure there's no breach of civil liberties going on.
Sure.
And that sort of stuff. And I thought, cool. I knew they were out there doing that, and I hadn't seen one before.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that.
I thought that was really cool. I thought, you know, now that's an awesome thing. And we live in a great province where you can have the organizing committee and the IOC come in and bombard you with a bunch of things that in some ways could breach civil liberties or have breached civil liberties.
I don't doubt it. Yeah.
And but still to live in a community where there's no way in hell that any, either the IOC or Vanop would deny or somehow put barriers up on the BC Civil Liberties Association, a very, you know, hard-working organization. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether or not you have criticism against them or not, you know, to put up an army of volunteers to just observe and to make sure things are being done. Like, that was pretty cool. I was pretty pleased all around that one, that there was an organization who took it upon themselves to make sure that there were volunteers out there doing that,
mm.
and that the people organizing it wasn't preventing it from happening. Great, all
right.
around, especially when
right.
you think about after China, us hosting after China.
Yeah.
And the fact that the opening ceremonies took place and the protest, there are a whole bunch of protesters came right up to the foot of BC Place, and the police, from what you could tell, from what you saw on television, stood there, let it happen. People, they weren't relegated to a small patch of land in a park
right.
across the bridge,
right.
way away, you know, 20
That's right.
minutes away from BC Place. They were right there. Good. I thought that was great.
The
right.
police did a specifically outstanding job that
yeah.
night.
Yeah.
yeah.
I was really
and
pleased.
That needs to be said.
And of course, you know, the whole rioting that took place with a little smashing of the windows. And one, I think it was slightly overblown in the press. I mean, CBC showed it like constantly every 15
right.
seconds on that
Typical.
Saturday. But but when you're not hosting the games, you can actually, I like watching CBC's coverage of the Olympics now because they're no longer the broadcaster of the game. So they actually are much more holistic. While when you're watching CTV, they can't show anything really negative about the games because they're the official broadcaster, right?
Right.
So I find that really interesting. But you know, I mean, there's a lot of bad things about what happened in terms of people taking a violent turn in protests, you know. But overall, I'm with you in that, you know, I wasn't quite sure how I was going to react when it came. And my sister was very much concerned about me and how I was going to kill her buzz. And her, like, very pro-Olympic feeling towards it. And you're right, you go out there. I mean, this one guy, I think he was mute. I don't think he spoke.
Mm-hmm.
But he just kept making noises to me with his camera. He wanted me to take pictures of him in a whole bunch of area, in the same, whole bunch of like four or five pictures in the sort of Granville where those trees are with the lamps, lanterns.
Oh, yes, okay.
The Acer thing, right?
Right.
That was really cool.
Pretty cool.
That was like the day before the opening ceremonies. And I'm more than happy to take pictures, you know, for him. And standing there with my sister watching, you know, the silver medalist in Ariel's, whatever, the first medal that we got for Canada, in a screen in downtown with, like, 30 people just watching, just chatting, like, pretty cool. Like, you know, and what I have to admit, and admit with some pride in that, not pride, but just admiration, is that the Olympic movement, irrespective of what it takes to get the Olympics here, the Olympic movement itself understands the human spirit and understands what joy is and can tell a great story.
Yeah.
Like the story of the athletes that are reaching for their goal and fail, reach for their goal and win and succeed. Those are human stories of an individual level that are very powerful.
For sure.
And just, you know, all of us going downtown in Robson is an individual experience of a collective thing, you know. It's quite something. Like the energy is there, the human spirit is there,
and it's there. And that we never have that kind of energy here, by the way.
Yeah,
we just don't. Anyway, we keep
going. And it's just in the crowd, so I'm not a crowd person, but you know, it's quite impressive.
Well, I was talking to some people about that, like you know, the crowds, I'm used to, you know, like, rock crowds, but I'm not used to big sports crowds. I'm just not, you know. We might go to the odd football game or something, you know. There's a lot of, like, 60,000 people or whatever, but the difference is, for the Olympics, it's not just the, you know, but there's families, like, whole families out there all together, and it is a different vibe.
And what I'm hearing, too, is what I was afraid of, too, is that there would be no one was getting tickets or no one was doing this. And, you know, I've gone to two events.
Yeah.
And a lot of people I've spoken to, they either have tickets or they had the opportunity but decided not to, or just they don't have tickets because they weren't interested in getting tickets, you know. I haven't heard and when the first, you know, they had three rounds of mass release of tickets, and the first round, a lot of people didn't get anything, and I kept thinking, oh, this is going to be an Olympics that's sort of be so out of reach in terms of price, in terms of availability of tickets, and no one local will have a chance to get them. But I don't think that's been the case. I think a lot of people, and you when you were on Facebook, I mean, how many people are saying, oh, I've just come back from this event, and these are all local people who, you know, at least
just,
I'm
just like you and I.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, you know, there is like, the woman next to me in the men's hockey game was from Cape Breton, and she had a big flag, and she was going to like 6,000 events. Like, she had so many tickets. She was so happy. And then in the other game, there's people beside who was obviously local. Right. And so it's just, you know, it doesn't feel to me to be terribly elitist in that what I was concerned about in terms of the audience. So that was kind of cool. You know, that was kind of cool.
That was the part I was concerned about, was how elitist is this really going to turn into? And you made me think of something when you said that the woman from Cape Breton, because it's like, you know, even if we did all delude ourselves into thinking that this isn't a big Olympic globalization machine or whatever, you're getting people from all over the planet who are still coming here for that human spirit thing.
Right.
And I think that's pretty powerful. Like,
it is.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you might have some suits in the background who are really just pulling all these puppet strings, and it's just all bullshit. But, be that as it may, it's still people getting together and wanting to celebrate each other, And one of the nicest things I've heard from this whole thing was when China and Japan held up Canadian flags as well as their own when
right.
they came in.
Cool.
And I was just like, that's it.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's the thing, like, I think there is such a power, which is why Olympics will go on for a long time, because there is a purity still to the execution of it, and the being there of it. And, I mean, whether or not, I think it's totally worth, there's lots of value to have an Olympic Games, and we're feeling it right now. Is it worth it? Is that value worth $5.6 billion, the headaches we've had, or is it worth those people who are pulling strings, getting rich off it? You know, that's debatable, but there is value. There is a value to the Olympic ideals, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, and you don't get it until it's like right here.
Well, and that's a big point. Like, we were saying we were waiting 7 years for this, and we had been talking about it another 6 years before that,
yeah.
as a possibly this might happen one day, a very far distant thing, but it was kind of in our minds, you know.
Right.
So it's like it even 2 weeks before it came, it's different than when it's here.
Right.
And I think when the opening ceremonies happen, we were watching on TV, when you see the athletes come in, right? I mean, yeah, there's the musical performances, and Katie Lang was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I had tears. I will admit it. So did Elaine. And Dexter probably had a couple, too. But when you see the athletes come in, and you're like, oh, yeah. Like,
yeah.
These guys want to compete. You know, they want to have that human spirit moment.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, there's going to be a lot of shitty things that's going to happen along the way to getting this underway. And a lot of shitty things did happen. Some good things happened.
Yeah.
The Canada line happened.
Canada line happened.
You can't tell me that wasn't because of the Olympics. That was because of the Olympics that happened when it did.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it might have been an eventuality. An eventual necessity.
Eventually, if you define eventual as 20 years from now.
Yeah. that's what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fact that it happened that fast,
yeah.
and the funding came up that fast, was because of this. You can't tell me it wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't care what Jean-Claude Tiena says. Anyway, you know, we'll save maybe after the Olympics or a post-mortem, maybe a more negative that could change.
Yeah.
We could do that.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's going to be a huge total. But one thing I know is we probably met more in the middle on this than we probably imagined from years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, absolutely. And I think what I find really interesting is talking about with this with my sister, who is, as you know, very pro.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how she loves it so. Like, I've never really told her this, and now she'll hear it because she listens to this podcast. I really truly admire her ability to just love things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she loves Survivor still. She loves Amazing Race. She loves the Twilight books or movies or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
She loves Harry Potter. And I haven't felt that much love for anything in a long time. And we've talked about,
yeah,
you know, my own personal journeys about looking for passion and that sort of thing again, you know. So I do admire that greatly in my sister.
Yeah.
And I've had these conversations with her recently about the Olympics. And I've come to some realizations, you know, something about, you know, the juxtaposition of the pro and anti-Olympics camps, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, one, you know, people always say, you know, they pit athletes against homeless people, you know, athletes against, you know, like, why should we spend X of millions of dollars on high performance athletes or Olympic athletes or Olympic games when you could be spending it on homelessness or
mm-hmm.
or drug and alcohol treatment or whatever,
healthcare,
right? Or healthcare or what have you. And that, to me, is not the point. I don't think anyone would say an individual who has a healthy lifestyle, dedicated to his or her passion in sport, you know, no one would be against that person, you know?
Right, yeah.
While if you had a single mother struggling to keep her children fed, clothed, sheltered, educated, no one would not feel compelled to help that person in that family.
Yeah.
It's not those two were competing against each other, right? It's about the IOC or VANOC and how those are happening against some of the other issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's not about athletes against homeless people.
Yeah,
or,
that's right.
It's about decisions around infrastructure, decisions on how you do, you know, so...
Like the coexisting of athletes.
Yeah, and so I just think, you know, what really happens is... It's emotional to talk about the single mother or the Mayelle Rickard out there who is so lovable when you see her win her gold medal in snowboard cross.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she smiles and she talks and she's talking while she's smiling and she giggles after every sentence. Like, how do you not love her, right?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You know, so, but that's the pro and the anti-camps just clutch onto those emotional things. And it's like anything when you talk about, you know, pro-Palestine or... pro-Israel or, you know, pro or against pro-abortion, anti-abortion. It's the emotional thing that people just are talking through each other, at each other, and not, you know, not talking with each other. And I think the majority of people that I know, like you and like Elaine and like everyone else of who we know who are not necessarily anti-Olympics but skeptical about how things have unfolded.
Right.
We get lumped in with the vocal majority, the vocal minority who was so anti-Olympics.
Yeah.
Or for just no other reason than they're anti-Olympics.
Correct.
Well, not no other reason, but, you know, there's a myriad of reasons why they're
anti-Olympics.
But
there are some,
right?
Like that, yeah.
And then there's those who are so pro-Olympics, and I think there's more people who are pro-Olympics than there are the fervent pro than there are the fervent negative.
Right.
You know, I think their numbers. Like, my sister's definitely a fervent pro. And when you're so pro or so anti, you just can't hear. But there's, I think, just people who are smart, who live in this community, who understand the complexities of what's happening. And you try to talk to someone who's very pro, they don't want to hear.
They don't.
They don't want to listen.
And that was the biggest problem that I always had, or Elaine had, or whoever. You brought us on, I was going to mention before, I forgot. It's the... blindness to, it's like they just don't want to know about, you know, any of the imperfections or the problems created by undertaking this thing.
And just because, you know, some of us are skeptical, and most of the people who I know have been, you know, healthy skepticism about it, are been just like you and I, not transformed, but definitely go, you know, hey, there's value in the Olympics. We get it.
Mm-hmm.
We're excited. We want to go to an event or two, maybe buy a hoodie or,
you know,
buy the mitts and just get, have some fun. Like, we're not like curmudgeon-y people that won't have fun.
Right.
Like, you know, but people don't get that. You know, I think you can be skeptical of something, but still be able to embrace it, enjoy it and for what it is. And it's here. Like, I had this great conversation with my sister driving somewhere back from something, and we're talking about the torch relay. You know, I said, well, what happens if the, you know, what would you feel if you saw on the news a story about, you know, she talked about, you know, the torch relay and how sometimes protesters sort of, you know, ruined the torch relay and they had
that
to
woman fell.
A woman fell, got tackled, and
Victoria
things like that, right?
Yeah.
And whether or not that was, you know, she's like, oh, I can't stand that. It's just so awful. And I said, okay, well, you know, if that's the only piece of the story, then yeah, it's pretty bad. You know, like, you shouldn't let that happen, or you ruin someone's experience. You know, you're tackling them or whatever. And I said, well, let's just dissect it a little bit. And I know it's a hypothetical, and you know, it's kind of hypothetical. It can be kind of crazy. But let's say what happens if the person running the torch is the CEO of Walmart. You know, and say Walmart is a sponsor. I don't know if they are. They probably aren't. But you never know, right?
Yeah.
And he's running the torch, and some protesters come and tackle him or you know, just divert the router, and his family don't get to see him run the torch. You know, would you think that was okay? She's like, well, no, because, you know, it
it ruins the experience for the torchbearer. Mm-hmm. And his family, who may want to see him, and maybe his kids and his grandkids don't get to see the torch. You know, that's kind of really sad. And it ruins the experience for them. It's like, well, yeah, that's true. But what happens if you find out that the protester was protesting the fact that she was an employee at Walmart, but being paid less than a living wage, and her children, cannot survive on that, and she did that to prove a point, just to get some press for her plight.
Right.
Oh, I never thought of that. Or and I mean, again, it's a hypothetical, and it's kind of pulling
almost far fetched.
Yeah,
but yeah,
almost far fetched, right? But for my sister, who's so very like her own, I said, tell me how far does your thinking go? You know,
right,
like,
right.
Do you ask your inquisitive questions? I mean, she's a journalist, right? So she's got the power and the ability and skill to go from one question to an answer, which leads to another question, to another question, to another question, right? So she has it in her. And she's going to hate me that I'm saying this story.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering how...
Yeah, yeah. She said, oh, you know, I just only thought about the family of the torchbearer.
Right.
And I thought that was just really interesting. Like, someone who has the critical thinking to go to level B, level C, level D, level E, level F, you know, because it's a topic or a subject area which she loves so much, she... it doesn't kick in to go... to ask a few questions. Like, if I saw that in the story, like Victoria, when the woman I was curious. Well, so what was, you know, and I didn't do much thinking and so much research. And in the end, I think it was just a myriad of different, you know, the protesters that seemed to be here is about, like, no 9/11, no oil sands, no tar sands, and that sort of stuff, right? So there wasn't that compelling story to go down to that level. It wasn't there.
Yeah.
But I always get skeptical, you know, when people don't want to find out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are so blind, not blinded, so
not
so into something or so anti something. It goes both ways, right?
It does.
That they don't question or they don't go into more layers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to bring up something completely awful that's out of left field is. And that was sort of my reasoning about going to our 10-year high school reunion, when everyone around us was so negative about it.
including me.
Including you. And that, to me, made me very skeptical about, you know, I was never really that keen on going anyways, but the fact that everyone was so dead set against it, it made me question myself and think, you know, do I let myself ride into that same opinion, or do I step back for a second and go, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world, and I'm sure you would agree,
not the
you know,
worst thing
going
in the world.
To your grade 10 reunion, or 10-year reunion, high school reunion, isn't the worst thing in the world, and I was surprised how much of a visceral reaction people were having anti this thing.
Yeah.
And so for me, it wasn't just the fact that I actually didn't end up having any opinion about it, because I just was so suspicious about being so anti that I had to go just to make sure I wasn't regretting something, or I wasn't going to be blinded by an opinion that was
right.
very quickly formed.
Yeah.
And of course it was just whatever, you know, but so it's the same sort of thing where I get that skepticism, which is, again, I think partly for me is the problem that I have about not feeling passionate or in love with anything, because I don't allow myself. I have to be even-handed about everything, and which is why I love
That's
my sister
right.
for what she does, but she can just love something.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can love anything and be so into stuff and have passions and be even-handed about things. So that's a real issue that I have for myself have to figure out. No, I've talked too long, but that was my big point.
No. I fully agree with all that. I think it's just that emotional tug. I think it's just things that appeal to us that, you know, if it's an initial endorphin moment, why question it?
Yeah, and you know, that's exactly it. Why question it? You should just, I mean, maybe question things if it's high on the negative side, because I think it's always, you know, maybe having such pure hate for things is probably not that strong, that healthy. Wow. But having pure love for things, why not? You know.
Well, that's the thing. I think people would rather have that love or passion for something initially than to feel negative. Negative energy is negative energy.
Yeah.
Whether it's warranted or not, it's still negative
Brussels
energy.
Brussels sprouts or not. That's for my brother.
But, no, I agree. I think, you know, I've always been back and forth on stuff about the Olympics because I really liked it as a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all watched when it was in Calgary, and we remember that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
We remember the Summer Olympics that same year when Ben Johnson did amazing.
Ben.
And that was a huge moment. We were 11, but that was a huge moment for us because we were just really getting stream of conscious of things, you know, early teens, whatever. And so to just be so, no, like, it's really tough. I think, though, you know, and we can expand this on the next episode, but I'm always weary, and that's the word that Elaine uses, which I really like that word, weary of a lot of things about the Olympics that, no, I'm not trying to turn this into a dark conversation, but weary of the cost. And it, I don't just mean numbers, I mean numbers, but I mean, there's other things that go along with it that we can explore next time, but I,
sure.
And I think that it's about staying sober. Because we're all feeling this high, we're all getting all excited, and I admit, I feel it too. You know,
I'd
be lying if I said I didn't feel
I think
that.
Olympics are on television 24/7 at my house right now.
Yeah.
I fall asleep on the couch and I wake up, it's 3:00 in the morning, and there it is.
How can
it's
you not? How many channels is it on? I mean, it's crazy. We just got cable just 2 weeks before it started, and it's all over our TV. Like, what are we supposed to do? But anyway, I think that was a good discussion. I think it points out to a lot of things that a lot of people feel. I think even the most fervent of pro, and I think your sister gets it too, is that she or others may not want to dwell on it, but those thoughts go in the head. And I think,
yeah.
I think, you know, we're inundated with the negative viewpoint, so we kind of get where they're coming from, but...
Yeah.
But we choose to kind of live on the positive side. And I mean we is a very broad we. I'm not necessarily saying me every moment of the way. But but there is a lot of joy out there, and I feel it. And I think hopefully it will be this way for the last week. And we'll see where we're at after it's done.
More joy and more cowbell.
Well, I think that ends it there. See, we have to, every podcast we do this, we do our little quip, and one of us, you or both of us, you know, will laugh, and then we do a pause, and that's where the end music comes in. So,
oh, really? Okay.
Anyway.
I think got our title, More Joy, More Cowbell.
Nice. Perfect. Okay, well, so you can find us at thedotmatrix.com.
Yes,
and
you can, on that, you can... probably listen to our 24th podcast, which is probably what I thought today was going to be. So, you know,
it's still up there. I think all of them are up there.
Cool.
But you probably only be able to find the last few on iTunes. I'm not sure. I haven't been there in a while. But you'll find us, the Dot Matrix. So just remember that. And
cool.
So we'll see you in early March.
Yes, and we will, as always, promise to get this up ASAP. We have to get us up before the Olympics close.
Actually, we have to do that.
But there's only two topics, so I can write this.
Yeah, okay, there we go. Boom, done.
Okay.
Done.